Let's see. Oh, we are. All right, we're good to go. So, anyways, how many of you were here last week? So we have one, two, three. Were you here last week? Okay, so you were here last week, and then everyone who was here last week isn't here this week. So I don't know if that will. Pardon? Well, anyways, so I am glad you all are here tonight, and hopefully you won't lose too much from not being here last week, because it's kind of building on what we covered last week. But we'll give a quick review of where we've been so far in the series. This is the seventh lesson, and so we had five lessons, and then we had a break, and then we had a lesson last week and a lesson this week. And so we started out in the very first lesson of the series talking about the proper goal of Bible reading. And the goal that we set out, the goal that we set, that the whole course is designed to help us achieve, is the proper goal of Bible reading and study is to understand the original inspired meaning of the text and then to allow that meaning to transform our lives in the present. And we talked about how we're going to achieve that goal. How could we accomplish such a goal? That was what we talked about in the second lesson. And we started with five foundational questions, and I didn't mention it in that second lesson, but these five foundational questions with this particular wording applies most precisely to the epistles in the New Testament. Who's writing, and who's he writing to? The implied author and the implied audience. What is he saying? What's he talking about? And it's a three-part question. What's he talking about? What is he saying about what he's talking about? And putting the two together, what is the author saying to those to whom he's speaking about what he's talking about? Fourth question, how is he saying it? And this asks about the genre. And the fifth question is, why is he saying it? And so we talked about those five foundational questions. And then in the third lesson, we took those five foundational questions and I showed through a passage in the book of Philippians, actually, chapter 4, and verse 13 and the verses that precede it and follow it, we talked about how those five questions can help us to understand a passage in one of the books of the Paul's epistles and the other epistles we find in the New Testament. And we mentioned in that lesson three crucial things to remember about the epistles in particular. The units of meaning are that of the paragraph and the entire letter. The letters are occasional documents. And the logical flow is almost always the key to interpreting each letter as a whole. For those of you who haven't been here for the previous lessons, I have those available online, so there's more explanation of what I mean by all of that terminology. Then after talking about, so we had the first lesson was the introduction, what's the purpose, what's the point, what are we trying to get done? The second lesson we kind of talked about that purpose and point a little bit more, and then we worked into the five questions. The third lesson we used those five questions to deal with a passage from one of Paul's epistles. In the fourth lesson, we started to talk about interpreting Old Testament narrative and the way in which the environment of narrative functions differently from the environment of one of Paul's epistles. And we talked about how can we use these five questions, how can we shape them so that we can get what we need to interpret them well in the context and in the genre. We talked a lot about genre, literary genre, that there's different types of writing, and different types of writing require different types of reading, and so we talked about the five foundational questions for narrative. And the five questions for narrative, how does this story fit into the narrative in which it is found? And who are the characters in the story? What is happening in the story? How is the story being told, and why is the story being told? And we had, just as we had three crucial things to remember about the epistles, we had three crucial things to remember about Old Testament narrative. The units of meaning are stories composed of scenes and put together into overall narratives. The overall narrative is always selective. The inclusion of any particular story is driven by its contribution to the point and purpose of the narrative as a whole. And the individual stories can only be understood and applied in light of this overall point and purpose. And again, we spent a good deal of time talking about the way that terminology works. And so there was a lesson on the five foundational questions for narrative and the three crucial things to remember, and then we took that and we applied it to a particular story in Genesis chapter 24, a particular story found in the narrative of the Pentateuch, and applied those five questions and worked through it to show how they work in practice. Then after that, we had a break, and Brother Moss was teaching Bible, the conclusion of Old Testament Bible Survey. And we returned to the course, pardon me for that, we returned to the course last week, and we talked about the Gospels. and we talked about what the way that the Gospels and how the Gospels are more similar to Old Testament narrative than they are to the Epistles, but how the Gospels have some distinctions of their own, and how to read the Gospels, and the five questions for the Gospels, and the three important things to remember about the Gospels. And what we're going to do this week is we're going to go back and we're going to go through those five foundational questions and three essential things to remember. And we're going to do that, but having a particular passage in mind and explaining those points and re-referencing them in light of a particular pericope in the Gospels. And so hopefully, for those of you who weren't here, you'll be able to pick up on it. I had a little bit more detail on the theoretical side of it last week, and it'll be a little bit more, here's how it works in practice this week. But hopefully, those of you who weren't here will still be able to pick up on the gist of it. And so, we'll move forward. Last week, we began by talking about what the Gospels are not, focusing in particular on the way that unbelievers and, quote, superbelievers can both misunderstand the natures of the Gospels in ways that end up boiling down to much the same thing. And we then moved on to more positive ground and discussed four things that the Gospels are. We concluded with the adaptation of the five foundational questions for the environment of the Gospels. We covered a lot of ground, but the ground we covered was so important that we're going to take the time to cover it again, but this time working through a specific Gospel passage. By God's grace, by the time we conclude tonight, you'll not just have had a recitation of some notes, but you'll actually have seen from the scripture what I'm talking about. Doesn't mean you're going to agree with every detail of the way I present it, but I want you to see the process, the way of reading the Gospels that will help us to understand what the Gospels are actually saying. And the passage that we'll begin with is Mark chapter 8 and verse 27 through 30, and we'll talk about the delimitation of the path. We'll talk about the actual, you know, why this particular group of verses here in a minute. But for now, just turn your Bibles to Mark 8, 27 through 30. And of course, we'll be considering the passages that immediately precede and follow it, as well as the structure of the book as a whole. And while you're turning there, I'll just go ahead and read it, and we'll be referring back to it. And Jesus went out and his disciples into the towns of Caesarea Philippi. And by the way, he asked his disciples, saying unto them, "Whom do men say that I am?" And they answered, "John the Baptist. But some say Elias, and others, one of the prophets." And he saith unto them, "But whom say ye that I am?" And Peter answereth and saith unto him, "Thou art the Christ." And he charged them that they should tell no man of him. And so, when we talked about the Gospels, we had four things about what the Gospels are. So three of them were the three crucial things to remember that we have for each of the major genres that we're discussing. And one of them was kind of a general statement about the Gospels. It's not one of the three. I'm trying to have a kind of a consistent format to the different major genres we're talking about. We've got five foundational questions and three crucial things to remember, but those three crucial things are certainly not the only things that could be said. They're just the ones that I think are important to remember when I'm picking a list of three. So the first more general statement is that the Gospels are theological biographies that have each been shaped by the Spirit to give a unique viewpoint on who Christ is that we would not have without that gospel. This is no less true of the Gospel of Mark. Whether you take Mark as the earliest gospel, as I do, or take this coming after Matthew and Luke, as some rather vehemently argue to the contrary, the fundamental task of interpretation is to understand the original inspired meaning the Spirit inspired the original author of the Gospel of Mark to communicate. As I mentioned in the conclusion last week, it is only to the degree that we see the glory of Christ through the lens that each gospel writer was inspired to show Christ that we are reading the Gospels as God intended us to read them. So that is a general statement about the nature of the Gospels. Now, for the three particulars, the units of meaning are pericopes. That is spelled P-E-R-I-C-O-P-E-S. And there's nothing magical or really all that special about that term, but it's just the one that scholars will normally use to refer to the sections, typically of one to three paragraphs, though occasionally longer or shorter, that are the primary building blocks of the Gospels in the way that sentences and paragraphs are the building blocks of the epistles, and in the way that scenes and stories are the building block of the narratives of the Old Testament. And these units are primarily set off by a change of speaker, audience, subject, setting, or scene. And the more of these items that change, the more certain you can be that you've got the right pericope division. Just like there's a whole range of connectives and things like that, different therefores and wherefores in Paul's epistles, that if you kind of sketch out the logical flow and you see where there's a major logical division or whatnot, that's how Paul's letters are structured. Well, in the Gospels, they're structured around these pericopes. And when you have some of these elements change, the more that change, the more certain you can be that you've got the right division. If you look at Mark 8:27, you'll find that at least three, possibly four, of these five elements have changed between 8:26 and 8:27. 8:26, and he sent him, that's the blind, and we'll refer to this story back, as the man, the blind man that Jesus had healed, away to his house, saying, neither go in to the town, nor tell it to any in the town. And when you get to verse 27, so Jesus is the one speaking in 26, and Jesus is speaking to a blind man about the blind man's healing. When you get to verse 27, so Jesus is now addressing his disciples, not the blind man that was healed. They're in a different place. He's talking about a different subject. And so the subject has changed, the scene has changed, and the people being addressed have changed. And it seemed to be that after they went out, now the time has changed as well. That's why I said possibly four, though that's not made explicit. So it's very clear that we've got a pericope division between 8:26 and 8:27. And that clarity is universally recognized, as far as I can tell. And in order to say that there's almost universal agreement, I checked five different translations, three different Greek New Testaments, and a synopsis. And I've also read several commentaries in the Gospel of Mark, and all of them place a major division between 8:26 and 8:27. So when I say there's near universal agreement, I mean there's near universal agreement that there is a division of some sort between 8:26 and 8:27. In fact, it's the turning point of the entire book, but that's something we'll get to in a little bit. Now, when you look at verse 8:30, so chapter 8 and verse 30, so the verse that comes after, the division is far less clear. And he charged them that they should tell no man of him. And so when you get from chapter 8:29 to 8:30, the only thing that's changed, so they're still in the same place, and he's still addressing his disciples, and it's still at the same time, but he's changing the subject. So, sorry, from 8:30 to 8:31. And he charged them that they should tell no man of him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things. Sorry, I read that wrong. So from 8:30 to 8:31, Jesus has changed the subject. Before, he was talking about whom do men say that I am. And in 8:31, he begins to speak to the disciples about his sufferings. And so there is a kind of a division of sorts, but it's not nearly as clear cut. And that's reflected in all the sources that I mentioned beforehand. Some that go for longer divisions. So if you have paragraph markings in the King James, you'll see that the next paragraph marking is found at 8:34, where there's a much clearer division. Others will break at 8:30 and have a separate between 8:30 and 8:31. And so really, there's definitely, when you talk about the pericopes and you talk about the division into here, the units, there's really clear cleft divisions, so that it would make no sense at all to kind of take 8:26 and 8:27 as a unit to themselves, where you kind of get, you know, this side and this side of a real clear-cut division. But whereas it might make good sense, depending on how quickly you are trying to get through the Gospel of Mark, to take 8:27 through 8:33 as opposed to 8:27 through 8:30. Does that make sense up to this point? Any questions? So anyways, but for our purposes, and so there's kind of like, there are clear-cut distinctions, and then there are ones where it's like, well, this is, you could make a division here or you might not. And for our purposes tonight, we'll take the pericope as being 8:27 to 8:30. And another aspect to that is that there's actually, you know, kind of levels of division, that there's, you know, major divisions, and you have that in an outline. I'm not saying they've worked with a formal outline, but you have that in a lot of books as well. So that's the first principle. The first principle is that the first thing to remember is that the units of meaning are pericopes. Number two, the selectivity, and this is a mouthful. So the selectivity, arrangement, and adaptation of each gospel narrative has been shaped by the theological perspective and literary technique the Spirit inspired each writer to use. I'll read that again. The selectivity, arrangement, and adaptation of each gospel narrative has been shaped by the theological perspective and literary technique the Spirit inspired each writer to use. These three tools of selectivity, arrangement, and adaptation are what each gospel writer, under the inspiration of the Holy Spirit, used to present the particular view of Christ that the Spirit wanted them to present, and the particular literary technique that he wanted them to use to present it. There's a variety of literary style between the four Gospels, as well as a variety of literary structure. The Greek, for instance, of Mark is much simpler, much more of a Greek as a second language, or as we, how many of you are familiar with the term international English? No one's familiar with it, so it's not a good illustration. Well, you are. Okay. So international English, so like if someone in India learns English and they use it for business, that's international English. So it's a basic grasp of the language, but they're not going to write the next English novel that is, you know, has all huge vocabulary and all of that. It's a much simpler use of the English language. And so in international English, and there's actually even dictionaries and grammars of international English, the vocabulary is more limited. Then say if you compare, say, international business English to Charles Dickens, you're going to notice the following. The vocabulary is more limited. The syntax is the sentence structure. So there'll be a smaller range of sentence structures, a smaller range of vocabulary, and it will be much more influenced by the native language of the person who is speaking international English. So the international English of an Indian, someone from India, by whatever their native language would be, it Hindi or Tamil or whatnot, it's going to influence the syntax of the way they use English. The way that the, again, that's the way that sentences are structured is what syntax is talking about. And if you read the Gospel of Mark in Greek, you'll find that the Greek of Mark is rather simple. It's someone, Greek is not their first language, but they are competent in Greek. It's competent Greek, but it's very simple. And the way that the sentences are structured is very simple. And it's not flowery and literary. It's clear, but it's basically very simple Greek. If you read the Gospel of Luke in Greek, you will immediately notice a very striking difference. The vocabulary is much larger. The number of grammatical forms is much larger. It uses more obscure grammatical forms than the Gospel of Mark does. It's much more literary Greek, and it can be much more difficult to read, particularly in the book of Acts, also written by Luke. The sea voyage of Paul is some of the most difficult Greek in the New Testament. And we could get into a lot greater detail on this topic, but I think I might be the only one interested, so we will move on. I wasn't saying as far as your reaction, just that it would maybe not be as beneficial as some other things we could cover, and I don't want to bore you with pet topics of my own. Yet while literary style and structure are significant, and the selection, arrangement, and adaptation of particular pericopes is often influenced by literary considerations, the goal of the whole process is the theological point that is being made about Jesus through the Spirit-inspired use of these techniques. We'll be addressing that specific point in more detail as we continue. So the second point is the mouthful that we went over there. The selectivity, arrangement, and adaptation of each gospel narrative has been shaped by the theological perspective and literary technique the Spirit inspired each writer to use. Third point, though the gospels are to be studied both horizontally and vertically, horizontal study must always be subservient to a vertical understanding. And if you were not here last week, that's going to sound like a mess. But here's what it's talking about. And I would show you on the board, but I cannot find a marker. And so what it's talking about is, how many of you have ever seen a gospel synopsis? Okay. Do you see a gospel synopsis? So here's the way gospel synopsis is set up. You've got the four gospels. So you've got, let's say, Mark is here, Matthew's here, Luke is here, and John is here. And so the four gospels can be, and so they've got all the accounts that are parallel, or the accounts that are only in one gospel, or however. And so the four Gospels can be read horizontally. And so that's comparing comparing the account in this Gospel to the account in this Gospel to the account in this Gospel to the account in this Gospel. And so that's a horizontal reading of the Gospels. A vertical reading of the Gospels is when you read sequentially through one Gospel in particular. So that's reading down the synopsis. Does that make sense? It's a picture that's an illustration that I found in a book that we're using in the School of Ministry. I think it's a helpful one. And so I use it. Even though, until I explain the image, the point makes no sense. Are we good to go on with that point? Good? Good. Okay. Of our three crucial truths, this is the one we will spend the most time on, because it is something I want to be quite clear about. The particular passage we are discussing tonight, as I am sure you have noticed by this point, is Peter's famous confession of faith in Jesus. Without looking at the text, without looking at your Bibles, would anyone like to tell me what Peter says in the Gospel of Mark? When Peter confesses Christ, how does he describe Christ? What does he say? Anyone?
He fell
He's the Christ.
That's right.
And we read the text, so that was kind of why I felt a little torn about reading the text. Because many people, if you haven't just read the text of Mark, if you ask about Peter's confession, they will say Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, or the Son of God. That's the form that is found in the Gospel of Matthew and the Gospel of Luke. But in the Gospel of Mark, Mark does not say that Peter said that Jesus was the Son of God in this passage, and he also does not go on to include the praise that Jesus goes on to give to Peter in the account in Matthew chapter 16, which is where that language comes from, or the further teaching about the foundation of the church that follows that passage in the Gospel of Matthew. All that he says, in fact, is that Peter acknowledges Jesus as the Messiah. Christ is simply the Greek translation of Messiah, both meaning anointed one. And in the Markan account, Jesus then immediately goes on to tell them not to say anything about him being the Messiah to anyone. And then after that, he immediately begins to teach the disciples about the suffering that he was about to face. This is where understanding the way in which the Gospels are shaped becomes so vital. For this is exactly the kind of, quote, disagreement in particular detail that skeptics love if they've studied the Gospels enough to have any details at all to bring up. And the way we respond to these challenges will demonstrate whether or not our priority is to be as contradictory to the skeptics as possible, and this is something we spent some time on last week, though in the process rather silly becoming like the straw men they are attacking, or to actually understand the point that each gospel is making. If our focus is on the skeptics, we will simply become a mere image of their unbelief, and our lives will be far from reflecting the glory of Christ. And so the temptation when someone makes a criticism of Scripture to be as contradictory to that criticism as possible. But the problem is that if our paradigm comes from the critics and our response is just a mere image of their unbelief, then we're not listening to the Gospels any more carefully than they are. If our focus is on what the Gospels are actually saying, we will be enabled to see Christ in the way that the Gospel writers were inspired to show Christ. And as we go through what follows, I want to ask you to stay with me till I get to my point before you make a decision as to whether or not what I'm saying is accurate to the text. You don't have to agree with me, but if you don't, it needs to be because you don't think that what I'm saying reflects what the text is saying, not because you just, I don't know, why you would. The smaller the group gets, the more awkward it gets to say things like that. It's a lot easier when there's more people to say something generic like that. I'm sure some of you are very free to disagree with me, but if you are listening to the sound of my words, if you disagree with me, you need to be able to show why you disagree based on something that is in the text. Now, of course, if we were to try to capture every nuance of what's going on here in this passage, we would have to study the entirety of each gospel in order to see how the treatment of every other pericope in all four of the gospels connects together to the particular distinctions in this particular account in Mark. That's the work of a lifetime, both to learn and to communicate. So we're not going to try to do that tonight. So we'll just have to settle for considering the immediate context of this passage in the Gospel of Mark, and I'm going to compare and contrast it to its immediate context in the Gospel of Matthew. If you go to the account in the Gospel of Matthew, you don't have to turn there, you could if you would like, to the account that immediately precedes it. This is in chapter 16, verse 13, and the verse I'm referring to now is chapter 16 and verse 12. You'll find that it is the pericope in which Jesus tells the disciples to avoid the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. Matthew's account of this ends with this verse. Then understood they how that he bade them not beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and of the Sadducees. That is what, in Matthew's account, is the immediate context of Peter's confession on the road to Caesarea Philippi. Returning to Mark's gospel, we find that Mark has an additional pericope unique to his gospel that lies between Jesus' warning to the disciples about the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees and Peter's confession. Furthermore, in his recounting of that warning, he does not end it the way that Matthew ends it. It ends with Jesus saying in 8:21 of the Gospel of Mark, "How is it that you do not understand?" So it does not end with the statement that now the disciples get it. At the end of Mark's telling of the story, there is no explicit statement that the disciples have understood that Jesus is not talking about bread at all. Then Mark goes on to recount one of the oddest miracles in all of the Gospels. It's the only account in which Jesus heals someone, and they're not immediately completely healed. After Jesus applies the mud that he has made to the man's eyes, he is certainly no longer blind as he once was. However, at the same time, he does not see clearly either. He sees men as trees walking. So Jesus places his hand on the man's eyes again, and this time he sees all things with perfect clearness. It is immediately after this miracle that the pericope about Peter's confession follows. Reading horizontally, comparing Mark's account with another parallel account, has highlighted particular puzzling details, shown us things that we otherwise might have missed if all that we had was his account. So these particular things that are different about Mark's account from Matthew's account are things we would not necessarily have noticed if we hadn't had the other account to compare it to. Now, the temptation is to take all these details and to put them together into one big narrative of our own construction and take that as our gospel. Yet I would suggest to you that if we do that, we'll miss the point that the Spirit inspired Mark to make and replace it with the point of our own creation, and we'll equally miss the point that the Spirit inspired Matthew to make and replace it with another point of our own creation. Reading horizontally is valuable. Comparing gospel to gospel is valuable. But it is ever and always to be subservient to the vertical or sequential reading of each gospel narrative in particular. It is to that vertical reading by means of the five foundational questions that we will now turn. So our first question is, how does this pericope fit in the context of the book as a whole? As I mentioned before, I said we get back to it and now we have, this particular pericope is the turning point of the Gospel of Mark as a whole. By my very rough count, there are around 16 pericopes that deal with Jesus' healing ministry up until this two-stage healing of the blind man in 8:22-26. And many of those involve the healing of great multitudes, including many miracles, even though they are not all described. So it says things like he healed them all, and Jesus is doing a lot of healing, and he's working a lot of miracles. And after this, only roughly the midpoint of the gospel, there are only three. The casting out of the demon that Jesus' disciples were unable to cast out, the healing of Bartimaeus that comes after the third passion prediction, bracketing this section of Jesus' teaching between the healing of two blind men, and the symbolic withering of the fig tree. If you read the Gospel of Mark in one sitting, as I've done on several occasions in the past, then the transition is quite a striking one. So the first half of the Gospel of Mark, you've got miracles, 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 miracles. It seems like that's all Jesus does all day just for that. The teaching, very little teaching, and a lot of miracles. Second half of Mark's Gospel, very few miracles. Still, the miraculous power is still there, but there are very few accounts of healing, and there's much more focus on Jesus' instruction to his disciples about his coming and impending death, on what it means that Jesus is the Messiah. In both the account of Matthew and Mark, Jesus teaches about the suffering he's about to undergo in Jerusalem. But in Matthew, this teaching is not the immediate context of Peter's confession. It's not what comes immediately after it. The immediate context of Peter's confession in Matthew is rather Jesus' teaching about the foundation of the church. And it's only after this that he begins to talk about his suffering and death. So if you have the account in Matthew, you have the statement, they finally understand Jesus' teaching about the leaven, Peter's confession, more details of Peter's confession, and then Jesus applies Peter's confession and begins to talk about the church and gives other instruction, and then there comes, after another break, the passion prediction. The first of the three passion predictions that are found in each of the three synoptic gospels, Matthew, Mark, and Luke. And then in Mark's account, you've got the account of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees. It has a different ending than it has in Matthew. Then you have this strange story of the blind man and the two-stage healing. Then you have Peter's confession, a briefer version of Peter's confession. And then you immediately have teaching about suffering. That's the difference between, that's the structure of the two different accounts. We could continue on with such details, but in order to move on to our next question, I'll simply state my conclusion about the way this particular pericope fits in the context of the book of Mark as a whole. Up to this point in the gospel, Jesus has been doing mighty work after mighty work, and yet still, up to this point, his disciples have not explicitly acknowledged that he is the Messiah. They've never said, "You're the Christ," up till now. At this climactic moment, they finally acknowledge him as the divine Messiah. They see the light. Finally, they see. But they still see the light dimly. They may believe that Jesus is the Messiah, but they do not yet understand what it means for Jesus to be the Messiah. They aren't yet ready for the way of the cross. They still don't see clearly, and they won't until the resurrection. The first part of the Gospel of Mark is parallel to Jesus' putting of mud on the eyes of the blind man, and the second half is parallel to his enabling that blind man to understand correctly what he actually is seeing. And you don't have to agree with my reading of the structure of Mark's Gospel. It's certainly not unique to me, and not everyone agrees with it, but that isn't the point. if you read that, if you have a different perspective or you see things slightly differently, I'm not going to, that's fine. But the point of the lecture is that, and the point of the whole course is simply a plea for you to read the text of Scripture carefully enough to notice these kinds of structural, the way that the gospel is put together, and to see the point that is being made by the text of the gospel. Now, before we go on, I want to point out one thing I'm not saying. I am not saying that Matthew's account, in which the disciples seem to understand what Jesus is saying, and where Peter's confession of Christ is much fuller, or seems to be much clearer, contradicts in any way, shape, or form the account in Mark, in which Peter's confession is brief, and the emphasis is on the misunderstanding of the disciples. The reality is, if you stop and think about it for a moment, that both understanding and misunderstanding, they're not binary opposites. Understanding, misunderstanding are not right and left, east and west, by any stretch of the imaginations. No matter how well you think you understand something, if you're a human being, your understanding is always partial, always mixed with a partial misunderstanding. No matter how badly you misunderstand something, that misunderstanding is always mixed with at least some level of understanding, or it couldn't even be stated that you misunderstand a given topic if you have no understanding of that topic at all. There has to be some understanding for there to be misunderstanding. Even a broken clock is right twice a day, supposing it to be a normal clock and not a digital one, which could be wrong all day long. Could be off, in which case that'd be parallel to being dead. So I suppose you could be wrong about everything if you're dead. But we digress in that direction. The fundamental way in which the Gospels agree with one another is by presenting harmonious accounts of who Jesus was and therefore still is. They are never contradictory. Nowhere does one Gospel affirm a truth that another Gospel denies. Yet what they do constantly is to emphasize particular details in each story in order to draw out a particular angle on who Christ is, to shine the light from a slightly different direction. And we spent a lot more time on this last week as well, but here's what it boils down to. If you have a mental picture, idea of truth, so this is what I mean by a mental picture, idea of truth. You read an account and you form a mental picture. We always do that. You read a story, you form a picture in your mind of what that story looks like to you. The reality is that most of the details in your picture come from your mind, not from the story you actually read. That's just the way, that's how humans can communicate in brief form, because we fill in a lot of details from our memory, from our thoughts, from whatever. And so, if you have a mental picture idea of truth, then you're going to go to the Gospels and you're going to say, the mental picture that I form from the account in Mark has to fit the mental picture that I form from the account in Matthew. And so, the details of my mental pictures, in order for the Gospels to be without error, those details have to be forced to mesh. But that is not a claim that the Gospels make. In fact, that's a claim that's really dependent on a lot of other philosophical commitments that are part of our modern age, and we could get into a lot of technical discussion about that, but I'm going to skip it for now in the hopes that we'll get out on time. But yet to go on to hold that because these first thought mental pictures are different, the Gospel accounts therefore contradict one another, requires the presupposition that there is a, quote, absolute mental picture that would encompass all the complexities of what, quote, what really took place. And the truth is that the only one who ever sees any event in all of its complexity simultaneously is God himself. So that any event you look at, there's an infinite complexity to events. So that if you had were to have a mental picture that had every single detail, that could only be understood by God. Because we're not capable of either communicating or understanding every possible detail and implication that an event has. And the number of valid perspectives from which each event can be seen is quite literally infinite, which is something you and I will never be. Now, of course, only God has a God's eye view of reality. We can only see one perspective at a time, and therefore. Now, of course, this is not to say that just any perspective is valid. It is possible, as I'm sure you all know, to misrepresent an event, to offer a perspective that offers a distorted vision, deliberately or otherwise, of reality. This the Gospels never do. They complement one another. They do not contradict one another. The visions they give are always harmonious. They are a symphony in which each instrument is playing its own particular note. If you ever heard a symphony orchestra and you've ever seen a symphony score, every instrument will have, and I'm not an expert musician, so I would be willing to be subject to correction on the details of this illustration. But I would certainly say that each section of instruments has a different set of notes. And when you have a symphonic composition, then there'll be some notes being played by this instrument over here, and some notes being played perhaps by the brass, and some notes being played perhaps by the string, and yet they come together and they work together to form a unified symphony of various instruments. They are a symphony. The Gospels are a symphony in which each instrument is playing its own particular note, but all of those notes, as in a well-trained orchestra, are in agreement with the, only this time, infinitely complex score that only the capital C conductor can read. We can hear the beautiful music. We cannot read the score, but we can acknowledge the perfection in the Gospels of each of the perspectives that is being given to us by that conductor. And, of course, all those illustrations break down at one point or another, so I won't press all the details. And so that is the first of our five questions, and the rest of them we will go through much more briefly. In its context in the Gospel in which it is found, who is being addressed in this pericope? In this pericope, it is the disciples, those who have committed themselves to follow Christ, of whom he asked these questions. This question, whom do men say that I am, and whom do ye say that I am? It is not a question addressed to hostile outsiders, but to those who Jesus has been living with day in and day out for some time already. What is this? So that's our second question. Our third question is, what is this pericope telling you about Jesus? Would anyone like to, based on the study we've done so far, would anyone like to answer that or give any thoughts that you might have? What is this pericope that we have here, 8:27 to 8:30, what is it telling us about Jesus, both by itself and in the context in which it is found? How is it helping us to see Jesus more clearly, see Christ more clearly? Anyone? Naomi? Mm-hmm. That's good.
Also, there are certain people in their history they've been taught about their entire life. And he asks who to do the hands they have. They say some say you're alive. So what that's done is that's him trying to paint a picture to some of us or some of the people on just who he is. And he's trying to get them to acknowledge who he is. So mm-hmm. Both of those folks preach God.
One of the things on top of that is helping them to learn to define or differentiate.
Yes, exactly. That's very. I'd say that's very crucial to what's going on in the passage. Pardon? Yeah, that's something. I'd say that you'd find even more in the second aspect, in the context, and that's something I'm gonna draw out in a second too. But that's a very good point, because even though they understand, they have a lot to learn, and that's. Yeah, that's found in any good translation. The distinction there for sure, but that's true. That you know that some are saying this, some are saying that, and Peter answers in particular. Yeah. That's just found in the text. That's not really a translation. You know, there definitely are differences of translation, but that's just you know what the text says. That right there, it's pretty clear. I would say. Anyone else? Well. I will. The pericope is telling us first and foremost that Jesus is not simply another prophet. As Brother TJ mentioned, he's not even the greatest of prophets. He's the promised Messiah, the true anointed one of God. Yet in the context of the book of Mark as a whole, as Brother Josiah mentioned, it is also telling us that it is possible to recognize that Jesus is unique and yet to misunderstand him in very significant ways. And that ties into the teaching aspect that Naomi mentioned about. The disciples believed in Jesus, but they had no idea what believing in Jesus meant yet. And that belief in Jesus was expressed in particular by Peter, as Julie mentioned. And yet it was their responses when they realized what following Jesus really meant that demonstrated whether it had been Jesus they had really been following to begin with. And so all the disciples, including Judas, were saying, yes and amen, Jesus, you're the Messiah. And there's no reason to doubt that Judas really affirmed, Jesus, I think you're the Messiah. He was one of the disciples. He was there. There's no indication in the Gospels that Judas said, nah, I don't think so. But Judas was committed to his idea about discipleship. And even though the disciples were ignorant, when they learned more, they followed more. And there were others, the crowds you have in the Gospels, all the Gospels, but in Mark's Gospel in particular, you've kind of got this distinction between the enemies, the disciples, and those that are in between. And really, it was as what following Jesus, what it meant to follow Jesus became clearer and clearer, the distinction between those three groups became clearer as well. Naomi? Oh, yeah, absolutely. I'd say that's very possible. Yes, absolutely. And here's the point that I would make is that, you know, you can say the same thing as someone else. You can say, I want to follow Jesus. But whether or not you really want to follow Jesus is only going to become clear when following Jesus and following your own agenda had two different directions. And it was only Peter's idea of Christ was probably not all that better. Peter's idea of what it meant to be the Messiah was probably not all that more accurate than, say, Judas's or even the crowds. Maybe a little bit more accurate than the crowds. But his idea of what it meant to be the Messiah was wrong on many points. But when his idea about what it meant to be the Messiah, over time, it didn't get it right. But when after the resurrection he was confronted with the fact that he'd been wrong, he changed his mind. He didn't reject Christ's message in the resurrection. Does that make sense? And that's really, it was that time when they realized their responses, that their ideas had been wrong, well, they changed their ideas. And it's that, I don't know, what were you saying? Yeah, and you see that in the distinction in some of it when you get into studying Matthew's gospel more. Matthew's gospel presents Jesus much more as a teacher, and you've got specific. I mentioned this last week. You've got specific blocks of teaching, and it's just structured very differently. It's presenting Jesus in a different light. They both are accurate lights about who Jesus was, but Mark's gospel of all the gospels is presented the more of like a this is a sermon. This is a continuous drama that is kind of presenting this 1-2 kind of punch. And it's really, it's more, much more oral. In fact, the early church tradition is that the Gospel of Mark is based on Peter's preaching. And this is the way that Peter would preach the Gospel. And Mark was a follower of Peter and wrote it down in the Gospel. And there's very credible tradition to that effect, and there's very credible evidence in the Gospel. Now, that's not something that's inspired, but the tradition that ties the Gospel of Mark to the Apostle Peter is very old, very early. Well, I guess if it was early, it would be old, but it's very credible. And there's a lot of discussion when you talk about the defense of the credibility of the historical record of the Gospels, then that becomes a very crucial point. Yes, exactly. And that's kind of the way you get, when I talk about the literary structure, just to go back to that for a second, you'll notice in translation, depending on some translations will change this, but almost every, so the NIV, for instance, will change a lot of the connectives to have a greater variety, but in so that almost every sentence begins with and. If you read the Gospel of Mark in Greek, just about every sentence begins with and. It is remarkable. The Greek word is ke, and it's ke this, ke th- and there's another word, and immediately. So ke eftis, and immediately this, and immediately that. And so that actually ties in to the way that Hebrew is written, where almost every sentence begins with the word for and this, and then that, and then this, and then that. And is used in a very flexible way, and we would get into a lot of, I keep getting on that rabbit trail, I better get off or we won't get done. But anyways, that is, you know, like you said, the bullet points, that's kind of the way that Mark is written. And that has a lot more to do with the fact that both the Old Testament and the Gospel of Mark was designed primarily for oral recitation. And you notice when you are speaking, you use more simple connections because when you have a more elaborate connection, people can't go back and see exactly the way you connected this to this. And so it's much more sequential because people have to just kind of follow along with what you're saying. And the Gospel of Mark is written that way. That was not in my notes either. Getting all kinds of bonus things that are free, and I don't know how valuable. But anyways, so our fourth question is, how is the writer using this pericope to present Jesus? And this is the genre question. And really, when we have our three key things to remember, if you want to put those into the five questions, they're going to be under this fourth question. They're the genre questions, and it's kind of like, I said this at the beginning, when you talk about the genre, it's kind of like you've got to read it in order to figure out what the genre is, but then when you figure out what the genre is and the details of the way the genre works, then you want to go back and apply those at the beginning. So it's kind of like something that applies. It's not like a 1, 2, 3, 4. It's kind of like a 4, 1, 2, 3, 4, 1, 4, 1, 2, you know, it keeps coming back up. This pericope and the one that follows is an account of a dialogue that Jesus had with his disciples. So you've got the macro genre, the big picture, that these are gospels, and then in the gospels you have a lot of distinct types of stories. You've got parables, and they have some particular things to keep in mind when you're reading a parable, and you've got miracles, and you've got a lot of other things like that, and this is Jesus talking to his disciples. Fifth question, why did the original audience need to know this about Jesus? The original audience needed to, if they had not yet placed their faith in Christ, understand that he was indeed the Messiah. Yet those to whom Mark was first written were even more likely to be believers, who needed to understand that suffering, the way of the cross, was part of God's plan, both for his son and for them. The cross always precedes the glory. Those in the original audience who were unbelievers needed to hear the message of 8:27-30. Those in the original audience who had professed faith in Christ needed to understand 8:27-30 in the light of its context, and realize that, first, simply because they believed in Jesus didn't mean that they yet fully understood all that involved, and second, be encouraged to pursue the way of the cross, even though the way of glory often seemed to make more sense, even as it did to Peter in the verses that immediately follow in the passage. It is hard to believe that this is the seventh week of the course already, that we are coming to our completion. Next week, Lord willing, and I have struggled with writing this one more than any of the others, so Lord willing, we will have a lesson on reading the poetic literature of Scripture with understanding, and then there'll be a 3-week break, 2 on account of my exam, annual exams, and then 1 on account of the anniversary. The first 2 weeks you'll meet with a general Bible study, and then the third will be the anniversary, and we'll have special services for that, after which we'll conclude with the last 2 lessons of the course. And we are working also on plans starting this fall for a more structure and working on some of the details for the equipping classes and kind of laying out a schedule and getting some things. Yes, Brother TJ?
Mm-hmm. That was my fault. I'm not really here. You actually came in really well. So when I told you that I couldn't hear you from the volume, somehow your thing was actually.
Yeah, I am. I also made a change based on what you said as well. So it may have been that I changed the. Did you hear a lot of background noise?
I heard muffled.
Okay, I changed the amount of gain on it. So lowering it gives it a less static, but raising it makes it louder. So I kind of went just up a little bit, so that may have helped as well. So I thank you for bringing that to my attention, because that probably helped. Any questions before we conclude? Any questions we haven't covered yet, or any questions you want to bring up again? Oh, you're still trying to understand that picture? Okay, so here's what it is. So if you have a synopsis, then you've got columns. So you've got column, and they're arranged differently, and there's a lot of reasons and there's a lot of complexity to the way they're arranged, But you say you have, let's say we have Mark in this column, and we have Matthew in this column, and we have Luke in this column, and then we have John in this column. Now, there's, like I said, the way that a particular synopsis is arranged is going to have a lot more detail than this. But for the purposes of the illustration, the point is that, so let's say you've got Mark, and then you've got, in this column, right? And then you've got all of Matthew that parallels Mark, right? It's arranged right here. to match up to it. And so you actually will have in a synopsis, you'll have a lot of repeated material. So you'll have it both where it fits in. Well, it really depends on the particular one. But the illustration is that you can read each gospel starting in Mark 1:1 and ending at 16 and verse 20, right? So you can read through Mark. And in a synopsis, that means reading down the column. And so you can read down the column. You can read Matthew from chapter 1 to chapter 28. You can read Luke, and hopefully I don't make any mistakes with the numbers here. You can read Luke from 1 to 24, and you can read John from 1 to 22. So you can read through the chapters like that, or you could read Matthew 16, 13 through whatever, and Mark 8 through, do you see what I'm saying? So you can put them all together, or you can, and so understand Mark in light of what appears in primarily and what appears in Matthew, and understand Matthew primarily in terms of what appears in Luke or what appears in John, so that the context, you're taking them out of their context, and you're finding what you think is the same story and making that the context. Does that make sense? Versus that particular pericope isn't a context in the gospel in which it's found, and understanding that pericope in light of what comes before and what comes after it in the context in which God placed it, as opposed to the synopsis, which, while they can be valuable, I'm all for them, they are still a human construction, and they're still dependent on whether or not the person who put the synopsis together got it right or not, which they may do or they may not. And so does that make the illustration make more sense? Any other questions? Any other questions? Well, if there are no other questions, we will conclude. So I'll stop this recording here.